Hello, I'm Andrew Corbett, and we now enter into Section 3, Jesus Christ was a unique religious leader, fact or fiction? This is Topic 3.4, the claim that Jesus rose from the dead was invented hundreds of years later after his death, fact or fiction? This is what we're having a look at now. We always start with the conversation points, and they include: if scientists ever build an outer space planetary biosphere, enabling people from Earth to travel there and begin a colony, I would volunteer to go and be a part of it. Now, biosphere is essentially going to be a building that creates its own atmosphere, creates its own gardens and so on. Anyway. The science nutters, the science fiction nutters, they'll know what that means, and they will either agree or disagree, and that'll just get some fun discussion going, I hope. Secondly, unless someone gets married, they can never truly be happy. Agree or disagree? This might pique a conversation about relationships, whether you can be a single and be happy. Anyway, see how you go with that one. And the third one. There are times when I would rather skip mains and go straight to dessert. Agree or disagree? Again, I don't do silly very well, but I think this is a silly question. And if you're ever wondering if I've ever done something silly, that's about as close as I'm going to get to silly. And my wife is very upset that I don't do silly anywhere near enough. All right, this is our reflection. Meredith Mary Conan Davies was born and grew up in Tanzania, East Africa, as World War II was drawing to an end. Her English father worked for the Colonial Office, that is the British Colonial Office, in Tanzania. But when anti-colonial sentiment began to get increasingly hostile, Mary's parents knew that it was getting too dangerous for a five-year-old white girl. And I could well imagine that it would have been as well. Her mother never really had much interest in raising her young daughter, so was very keen to send her away to a boarding school in a foreign land. This was also the means by which her mother could concentrate on developing her religious life without the inconvenience of having to raise a child. I find that very, very sad. Anyway, Mary was sent to live on a small farm in rural Tasmania, down south of Hobart. Mary felt rejected and abandoned by her parents, no surprise there, which left an indelible scar on her emotionally. When she became a teenager, she moved from the country to Hobart. So in other words, she was living south of Hobart, probably an hour or so away from Hobart, and moved to the city, the capital city of Tasmania, Hobart, and lived with the Catholic nuns who worked at Calvary Hospital as nursing sisters. She herself then trained as a nurse, also at Calvary Hospital. But Mary began to live a double life. Despite living and working with Catholic nuns during the day, at night, Mary got involved in the party scene. She was now living in a way that she knew her mother would never have approved of, and in some way, her lifestyle was now really aimed at hurting her mother. But then all that changed when she discovered she was pregnant. It wasn't her mother that she now feared. It was the thought that she would now bring great shame to the nuns who had been so kind to her over the years, with whom she now lived and worked. Mary then made a decision, which she would later say would be her greatest and biggest regret, the greatest regret of her life. After she finished her training, and now dogged with intense guilt, Mary moved to London, where she worked as a nurse. It was there that she met a young agricultural student, Douglas Gresham, whose late stepfather was apparently a well-known author, but not known to Mary. Douglas instantly took a liking to Mary and repeatedly, unsuccessfully, asked her out on a date. But she was incapable of believing that anyone could love her after what she had secretly done. But eventually, after 3 years of dating and many rejected marriage proposals, Mary finally said yes, and they were married and then moved to Tasmania, where they took up farming. Mary expected that being married would finally be the very thing that would finally bring all the love she'd always longed for. As interest in the life and writings of Douglas' stepfather, C.S. Lewis, increased over the years, Douglas was busy with international travels, speaking tours and book signings, promoting the work of his stepfather. But Mary was now feeling neglected and very angry. Mary's frustration was increased as the responsibility for her growing family fell onto her. When she found her children's dirty dishes left on the dining table or in the kitchen sink, she often picked them up and smashed them on the kitchen floor. She needed an escape. She found some cassette recordings of Douglas' stepfather, which she began to listen to on her Walkman. If you don't know what a Walkman is, you probably don't know what a cassette is either. And you probably need to ask your parents or your grandparents. Anyway, she was listening to them on a Walkman. you could Google it, I guess. Now, it was a series of talks that C.S. Lewis gave during the Second World War called Mere Christianity. As Mary listened to her stepfather-in-law, something happened. Something strange happened in her heart. She became curious about the Bible, which Mr. Lewis, that is C.S. Lewis, was referring to. Douglas seemed to have several Bibles on his shelves, so she took one and began to read it. She started reading about Jesus, and what she read thrilled her. She discovered that God was the source of the love that she'd been longing for all along, just as C.S. Lewis had been referring to in those talks called Mere Christianity. She prayed and asked God to forgive her and save her. That night, Jesus filled her with his love and gave her a new heart, and the guilt and the shame of what she had done those years ago left her. Douglas and Mary went on to have 5 children and 11 grandchildren. They now reside in Malta and have done much to further the works of C.S. Lewis, including producing 3 movies in the Chronicles of Narnia series. Here's a question. This is for group discussion. Mary grew up in a very religious home with a very religious mother, but even despite her later interactions with Catholic nuns in Hobart, she still felt unloved. Here's the question. At what point in her story did she discover true love? And how did she discover it? Hopefully someone will offer that, well, it sounds like Douglas offered her true love, and I think that's a fair comment. But the truest love that she experienced was when she encountered God by listening to the book, the now book, Mere Christianity. Here's a quote from Dwight L. Moody. It's taken from a book that he wrote in 1881. The thief had nails through both hands so that he could not work. This is an important point. And a nail through each foot so that he could not run errands for the Lord. He could not lift a hand or a foot toward his salvation. And yet Christ offered him the gift of God, and he took it. Christ threw him a passport and took him into paradise. Dwight L. Moody in the book Let the Wicked Forsake His Way, page 12, 1881, published in London. Christianity stands or falls on whether its central claim, and the central claim of Christianity, is that Jesus Christ was crucified, buried, and then raised from the dead. It is generally accepted by scholars that Mark's Gospel was the first one to be written around AD 45, and that John's Gospel was the last to be written around AD 63. Each of these accounts describes Christ's resurrection, which occurred around AD 30. In historical terms, these accounts, that is, the accounts in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, appear remarkably early after the events they describe. This is an important point, by the way, because sometimes critics of the Bible claim that such things as the resurrection of Jesus was just an embellished legend. The problem with thinking that it was an embellished legend is it often takes centuries, not years, centuries, to develop a legend. You just can't create one and have it just, you know, explode around the world. Back in that day, without the internet or anything like that, it's just not going to happen. That's just not how it works at all. And so when we now come to the Bible, we come with this understanding that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written incredibly early. And for a long time, there were scholars who claimed that it wasn't even Matthew, and it wasn't really Mark, and it wasn't Luke, and it probably wasn't John. It was people who took their names to give credibility or authority to what they were writing. And now those things appear in the second century, maybe even later. Well, we now know that just can't be true. In fact, some scholars have pointed out that even if we never found the original manuscripts, that is, those copies of the Gospels from either early second century or so on, it wouldn't matter. And the reason it wouldn't matter is because even in the first century, we have people who are copying or quoting from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The point being is you can't quote something that hasn't been written yet. In other words, there is good evidence now that these Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were written well into the first century, not as late or after the first century, we should say. All right, so now as we look at the Bible and we're looking at the evidence for the resurrection of Christ, and at this point, all we're doing is we're looking to substantiate the claim, did this happen? Is there good reason to believe this happened? And so we look at this. The New Testament cites three sources for the early source of the belief that Jesus rose physically from the dead. Now this is, again, these sources might be wrong, but what we want to see is that they are early. In other words, they didn't eventuate in the way that a legend eventuates. So here they are. Number one, there was eyewitness testimony. So the sources claimed to be eyewitness testimonies. Both Matthew, Mark, Luke, or not so much Luke. Luke claims to have spoken with eyewitnesses, and John was certainly an eyewitness. Secondly, the early creeds of the church. Now, you've got to appreciate that there was a high rate of illiteracy. In other words, not everyone read and could read or write. But what they could do is to memorize poems, little sayings, little statements that had a bit of a rhythm or a rhyme to them. And what we have, these things are creeds. And the New Testament, it would be an exaggeration to say the New Testament is full of them. But many scholars are now pointing out how frequently they occur in the New Testament. The point there is that if you've got a creed statement, creed simply means I believe, or a creed is what we believe or what Christianity believes. If these are occurring in the New Testament, in the Gospels and the epistles that were written, and even the sharpest critics of the New Testament still acknowledge that Paul's epistles to the Romans and the Corinthians, at the very least, are genuine and were genuinely written in the 50s, possibly early 60s, very early 60s, because Paul was executed in AD 64. So therefore, obviously, it could not have been written. Sheer logic says it couldn't have been written after 64. So what we have is good evidence. If people are quoting these creeds by 55 AD, that means that that creed or those sets of creeds must have been well in existence before the time they were quoted. It just makes sense. In other words, these creeds are really, really early. And the third thing is apostolic traditions. And the apostolic traditions essentially are the epistles. So we have Peter writing that he witnessed the resurrected Christ. We have James, the brother of Christ, writing his epistle. We have the record of Luke in his gospel, who interviewed eyewitness testimonies. And we have Paul, who claims also an apostle, who claimed that he encountered the physical Jesus on the road to Damascus. He had Christ appear to him. So here we have question number one. The epistle to the Corinthians was written around AD 53. That is 23 years later, after the resurrection of Christ. According to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 and 4, which says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures." So there's the two verses. Now this is, Paul almost sounds like he's citing a creed. What was the most important aspects of the gospel that Paul preached, and how did Paul learn the details it describes? So Paul had an encounter with the resurrected Christ, but the details of Christ's resurrection Paul had to learn. But let's have a look. The fact is that he states that Christ died, Christ was buried, and Christ rose again. Now, he didn't know that because he encountered Christ on the road to Damascus. He encountered that because he had received it. He had heard it. And he uses the word received. That which, we pass on to you, that which we had received. So he has taken as reliable what he heard directly from Peter, James, and John. So that tells us again, this notion of the resurrection of Christ, it began very, very early. And in 1 Corinthians 15, pretty dramatic passage, Paul actually says Christ appeared up to 500 people at one time. And he says many of them are still alive today. Critics of the Bible often claim that many of the New Testament books and epistles were not written until the second century or after, long after the original apostles had died. It is further suggested that this much later composition of the New Testament incorporated the growing legends about Christ, his miracles, what he taught, and especially about his resurrection from the dead. But over recent years, more and more ancient copies of the New Testament books and epistles have been found, which have helped scholars to date the originals to well into the first century AD. Now, this is an important point historically. We think of those people who lived at the time of an event having the best vantage point about what actually happened and the significance of it. But the reality is, it takes the passage of time for people to realize the true significance of an event. So, question two. Paul's epistle to the Thessalonians was one of his earliest. So that was written around about AD 50. What source of authority for the gospel, that is, the message that Jesus had risen from the dead, did Paul refer to in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 6? Now listen to the language here. Paul says, "Now we command you, brothers, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you keep away from any brother who is walking in idleness and not in accord with the tradition that you received from us." So in other words, here we are 20 years later after the resurrection of Christ, and there are established traditions that have come about as a result of the resurrection of Christ. How is this evidence that the belief that Jesus had risen from the dead had developed very early after Christ's death and not a century later? So the answer would be that Paul refers to the traditions you received from us. So this suggests that the record, or that the belief that Christ had been raised from the dead had occurred and begun very early. So this is where, again, those critics of the Bible who claim that the Bible actually wasn't written until the second century, long after, and it was just written based on myths and legends. Well, we've actually got within the Bible itself, within the New Testament documents, really good evidence to suggest that there was traditions that had been kicking around for at least 20 years, that affirmed that he was seen, the resurrected Christ was seen. And so there we go. All right, question three. What does Paul's statement about water baptism in Romans chapter 6 and verse 4 reveal about the early church Christian belief that Jesus had been raised from the dead, right? So here's the question. And Romans chapter 6 verse 4 says, "We were buried therefore with him in baptism into death, in order that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, we too might walk in newness of life." So here we have this statement, again, based on water baptism. And we know that water baptism began on the day of Pentecost. This is 50 days after the resurrection of Christ. So that's pretty early. Water baptism took on this significance of anyone who became a Christian was identifying with the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Christ. Consider the evidences for the resurrection of Jesus. Number one, the transformation of the apostolic eyewitnesses. The apostolic eyewitnesses being the 11 surviving apostles and also Paul. Number two, Jesus had predicted it. Now, this is a pretty big deal because a lot of people will acknowledge that Jesus told the truth. You know, Jesus was a good man. You could hardly call someone who was a liar, an inveterate liar, a good man. That would be a stretch. But Jesus is acknowledged as a good man. And he said, I will be killed and I will be raised from the dead. So Jesus predicted it. And that's there's one record of that in Mark chapter 8, verse 31. "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days, rise again." So there we have the statement of Christ. Number three, Jesus had already given adumbrations of his power over death. Now, the people are going to be diving for their online dictionaries about that word adumbrations, as I was when I first heard that word. An adumbration is a foretaste. It's a glimpse into something that will happen in the future. So when Jesus raised various people from the dead, and I give an example there in Mark chapter 5, verse 35, down to verse 43, where the daughter of the nobleman has died, and Jesus comes in and raises her from the dead. Now, these examples of Jesus raising people from the dead, they are what we refer to as adumbrations. They were things that gave a bit of a hint, a bit of a glimpse that Jesus had power over death. So this is an important point. So when we talk about Jesus being raised from the dead, well, we already have samples of it. These are adumbrations. All right, four, the gospel accounts of the resurrection give embarrassing details about the apostles. This wouldn't have been included if they just made it up. I mean, if you were Peter, you wouldn't have women racing you to the tomb and winning. I mean, you wouldn't do it. It would be a disgrace to your manliness. But here, there are these things that we see in the Gospels where you think, gosh, that you know, if you're making it up, you wouldn't have, you know, the incredible place of women described in the resurrection accounts. You just wouldn't do it. You wouldn't do it. So there are some other embarrassing things about Christ's exchange with the disciples. When we read about something like Peter saying, "Oh, I'm going fishing." Well, you wouldn't put that into the story if you were starting from scratch and just inventing a story. You wouldn't put in these embarrassing details. That's the point that we've got there. And fifthly, even today, we know the burial place of Christ's body, and it's called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And there's actually really, really good evidence to point out that, this is indeed where Christ was buried. And number six, this is a big one. The hostile original opponents of Christianity who encountered the resurrected Jesus converted to Christianity. And examples of this include Saul of Tarsus and James, the half-brother of Jesus. So all of these, I hope, will lead you to have a really profitable discussion about the early evidence for why we can have great confidence believing that Christ not only was raised from the dead, but that it was believed that he was raised from the dead for all of the reasons we've just given in this study. Now, I hope that you will go around your group and ask for prayer points, and that you close off the evening by praying for one another. And you'll see me in you'll hear from me in our next study's topic 3.5. Emperor Constantine invented Christianity. Is that a fact or is that fiction? Until then, bye-bye.